Judge Siegel, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Recording Jennifer in progress. Presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 15, 2021. We have four cases on our calendar this morning. We're here on our first case, A210283, State of Minnesota versus Daquan Bell. Counsel, thank you so much for your patience this morning. We were having, as you know, some really challenging technical difficulties, and I really appreciate your patience while we were able to work through them. If we have any technical difficulties during the course of the argument, we'll stop the time. We'll try to contact you so that we can resolve whatever technical issues we're having. Hopefully, we've already worked all that out from our systems. Just a few things before we begin the argument this morning. Please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. Please pay attention to that running clock. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. And with that, counsel, you may begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Adam Lozo, and I represent the appellant, Daquan Bell. I'll start this argument like I started my reply brief, by discussing the sentencing issue, since that issue is the simplest for this court to decide. Mr. Bell's sentence includes a 360-month minimum term of imprisonment. The state agrees this minimum term of imprisonment would be an upward departure, but neither the court nor the parties intended to impose a departure, and accordingly, the court found no reason supporting departure at sentencing. Its sentencing order reflects that the court considered the sentence not to be a departure. The state's suggestion that this court might now affirm the unlawful sentence as an unintended upward departure has absolutely no support in the law and must be rejected. The state's position on this point directly contradicts the binding Rushton, where in a precedential decision with nearly identical facts, this court reversed a minimum term of imprisonment imposed pursuant to the same statute as here, because otherwise that minimum term would have been an unintended departure. The state's request here is also incompatible with the clear, long-standing case law specifically holding that a sentence cannot be affirmed as a departure when the district court did not find substantial and compelling reasons supporting a departure at sentencing. Rushton binds the decision here, as do cases like Geller and Williams. This court must reverse the 360-month term of imprisonment and remand for imposition of a lawful term within the applicable guidelines range. Before I turn to discussing some of the other issues in the case, I would like also just to draw this court's attention to a part of Rushton that I don't think I emphasized enough in my reply brief, which is footnote 3, which directly addresses some of the same arguments that the state makes in its brief, which explains why the sentence in that case, the minimum term of imprisonment couldn't be affirmed. Just as in Rushton, the 360-month minimum term of imprisonment here cannot be affirmed as an unintended upward departure when there were no substantial or compelling reasons or any reasons whatsoever for a departure found or even discussed in sentencing. So now I'd like to turn to the applicable guidelines range, because this court must reverse the minimum term of imprisonment and remand for imposition of a minimum term within the applicable guidelines range. Regarding that applicable range, the state also agrees that Mr. Bell may be assigned no more than 0.5 custody status points when he was assigned a full custody status point at sentencing. As this court has recognized in cases like Eubanks, which was cited in my reply brief, and like Anderson, which was decided by this court after the briefing was submitted, November 1st of this year, the guidelines require the sentencing court to round individual categories of points down before adding them together. This means that Mr. Bell's criminal history score is 3, and that on remand, the district court must be directed to impose a minimum term of imprisonment within the applicable range for 3, which is 153 to 216 months.
But the guidelines are silent with respect to the rounding of the custody status point, right?
Well, the guidelines do not specifically address one way or the other what to do with that 0.5 custody status points. But this court has decided that in the decisions that I cited, and the guidelines uniformly, when there's a question of a partial point, uniformly require rounding the point down. And so it would be inconsistent.
Mr. Lozo, sorry to interrupt, but I know you cite Eubanks for that proposition, but doesn't our decision, and that's a non-presidential one, but doesn't Chappelle actually say that we don't round that down?
Well, in Chappelle, this court, in that decision, if I'm recalling it correctly, essentially left it at felony point has to be rounded down, the half point, so the total score is 3.5 or whatever the number was in that case, 2.5. But then the question is, what happens with that? If the criminal history score is a 0.5, the guidelines also don't address how to decide that. On the grid that determines the presumptive sentence, there's no 0.5s. There's no 3.5, right. 2.5.
And right, so, but in Chappelle, we did not round the half point custody point down.
That's true. That is true. But in Eubanks, the court did. And I would suggest that I would argue that that's the proper way to do it, given that partial points are always rounded down under the guidelines, and that decision is more persuasive because not only is it consistent with the guidelines, but also it actually answers the question and solves the problem. If this court were to decide, it's 3.5, then that doesn't solve the problem because then the district court is left to determine, well, what to do with 3.5 now? The guidelines don't address what to do with 3.5.
Well, sure it does. I mean, you know, there's a grid and the grid has a 3 and a 4 and there's no 3.5. And so if you don't have a 4, then you can't sentence at a 4.
Exactly.
So the guidelines do provide what to do if you've got a 3.5.
Which is to sentence as if it's a 3, is what I understand you saying.
So my question is why do we have to remand with instructions to round the custody point down?
Well, the court could remand, if I'm understanding what you're saying, you're completely correct that the court could not just say it's 3.5, so I'm going to sentence as if it was a 4. So it has to be, so the sentence has to be within the range for a 3. So if the instructions are to sentence within that range, the court doesn't have to actually decide what to do with that half point.
Okay.
I would agree with that. So the critical part of the decision there would be that the instruction would be to sentence within the 3 range, regardless of any instruction on what to do or not do with that half a point. So if there are, I would love to entertain any other questions on the sentencing issue if they exist. And if not, I'll move to the plea withdrawal issue. Regarding that Mr. Bell was informed by the court that if he pled guilty, the quote, same process will apply to determine his release date as applies to prisoners serving non-life sentences, that his release date would be determined by his prison discipline record, quote, just like someone serving a 3-year sentence. That is untrue. And instead, whether and when he is ever released is entirely discretionary with the Commissioner of Corrections and depends on an assessment of a multitude of factors, including the views of the victims, law enforcement, the community, and whether Mr. Bell accomplishes affirmative tasks during his imprisonment. That intermittent release date scheme applies as a mandatory consequence under the statute Mr. Bell pled guilty to violating. It's a direct consequence of his plea, and because he was misinformed of and misunderstood that consequence, he must be permitted to withdraw them.
How is that a direct consequence? I'm having some trouble here with this argument, counsel, because by definition, whether someone is eligible for supervised release is a decision that is made at some point in the future based on events that have not yet occurred. So I don't see how it is a direct consequence that flows from the sentence.
So the direct consequence that flowed from his plea is that this indeterminate scheme applies to him. So whether he's eventually released at 30 years or 40 years or never, that in and of itself is not the consequence. The consequence is that from the moment the court accepted his plea, this indeterminate sentencing scheme applied to him. So the fact that...
What indeterminate sentencing scheme? Because supervised release is not sentencing.
Well, his supervised release date is the date at which he will be released from prison. So,
which is not yet determined.
That is true. As it wouldn't be for any prisoner. It's just that two different schemes determine when that date will be. So
So my question, my real question is this. So the supervised release scheme that you're talking about is in existence today. And it is entirely within the province of the legislature to determine whether this scheme is going to exist tomorrow or in 3 years or in 5 years or in 30 years. And it could become something completely different between now and the time that Mr. Bell or somebody in a similar situation could be eligible for release. So what do we make of that? I mean, because it's not really, it's determined, I mean, it does apply to someone who's eligible today, but it might be something completely different 30 years from now or 15 years from now, whenever he becomes eligible for release.
Well, I would argue that any subsequent change that makes it more difficult or changes the requirements for him to argue for or potentially obtain release wouldn't necessarily constitutionally apply to him. Anything that makes his sentence more onerous or more difficult to achieve his release 20 years down the future, I would question whether that could constitutionally apply to a crime that was committed before that law was changed. But the fact of the matter is that this court does not need to decide whether this is a direct consequence. I certainly would assert that it is because it affects the range of punishment that he faces. But he was specifically and directly misinformed by the court and by counsel on this. And so the direct versus collateral distinction doesn't need to be decided because the direct versus collateral distinction is irrelevant when he's misinformed of the consequence.
So you're hanging your hat on a ineffective assistance claim?
Well, on the misinformation, there are two different claims. So one is an ineffective assistance claim, certainly. And the other claim is that his plea was involuntary and unintelligent because he was misinformed of the consequences of the plea by the court. And that information induced his plea. This can be
But that's not why he wanted to withdraw his plea. I mean, to be fair, the record here is very clear that he waited until he had to put this victim on the stand and go through this terrible, very heart-wrenching testimony that was very difficult for this victim. And then he took the deal. And then after the jury was discharged, the very next day, he tells his lawyer, I made a mistake. Get me out of this deal. And they didn't come up with this reason that you're arguing now that he was misinformed of the supervised release consequence until much later. So that's not really why he wanted to withdraw his plea.
Well,
so I don't really see where there's a injustice here or that his plea was involuntary or was somehow induced by this, by this misinformation. I agree he was misinformed, but I don't see it as really consequential in this particular case.
So a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. So the plea deal that was entered and agreed to did not exist, was never offered before trial or mid-trial. This was a new plea agreement that came up that was negotiated in the middle of trial. So I don't know that it would be accurate to say, certainly you're right that the plea came mid-trial after testimony occurred, but it's not true. It's not accurate to say that this is a plea deal that he agreed to accept after the testimony. The plea deal was negotiated and entered into after the testimony. But I think what's important here is that, as Your Honor just recognized, he was misinformed about the consequences of the plea. So the question then becomes, is it reasonably likely that he would have pled guilty if he had been accurately informed? And I think that the record does show that whether he would be released upon completing his minimum term of imprisonment was the crucial factor in his decision whether to accept this plea.
Well, but Mr. Lozo, isn't really the question of what he was misinformed about. Wasn't he misinformed about his eligibility for parole? And as Judge Frisch noted, that's something that occurs after his sentence has essentially been completed. And both the attorney and the district court made it clear that, you know, it's not up for us to decide how you become eligible for parole. That's up to the Commissioner of Corrections. That's not for the judge to decide in terms of sentencing when you're going to be released.
Well, that's the distinction here is that what Mr. Bell was specifically told is that his sentence was going to be a determinate sentence where after you serve your minimum term of imprisonment, like someone serving a three-year sentence, you will be released at 2 years plus any disciplinary confinement time. The district court specifically used that example of, if this is just like if you were serving a three-year sentence, you'd do 2 years plus any disciplinary confinement time. Now, it's true with either a determinate or indeterminate sentence that no one can say in advance, this is exactly the day you will be released. That's because with a determinate sentence, it would be the release date plus any disciplinary confinement time. But with Mr. Bell's sentence, it's completely different. At the date that he becomes eligible for parole 30 years from now, there is a whole host of factors that are determined simply by the commissioner's discretion.
But isn't that a collateral consequences of when and how he would be eligible for parole? That is something that occurs later. That's not something that can be determined by the sentencing court.
The sentencing court certainly could have given accurate information about how the decision is made.
But what does that matter in terms of that? That's a collateral consequence.
Because if he is misinformed of a collateral consequence by either counsel or the court, that leads to an injustice requiring plea withdrawal, an involuntary and unintelligent plea. I agree that if nobody had said anything, if it's a collateral consequence, and I see my time is up. Can I finish the answer?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. I agree that if you decide that the consequence is collateral, if no one had said anything about it, he doesn't get relief. But if you decide the consequence is collateral, if he is misinformed of it and that misinformation induces the plea is involuntary and unintelligent. And he has to be able to withdraw it.
So on rebuttal, if you could just address what evidence there is in the record that might have induced him to accept the plea.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I can do that right now or on rebuttal.
No.
On rebuttal is fine, counsel.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Mr. Loza, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Vokes, go ahead.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm because no manifest injustice exists that would require withdrawal of appellant's plea, nor would it be fair and just to allow him to do so. Instead, this court should remand solely on the issue of sentencing for the offenses to be sentenced in the correct order upon a correct criminal history score. Appellant's actual prison sentence would remain the same, a life sentence. And respondent respectfully requests that on the facts specific to this case, that this court affirm what essentially constitutes an upward departure in the minimum term of incarceration that was pronounced by the district court.
So is there any authority that would allow the imposition of an upward departure without a finding of substantial and compelling reasons to impose the departure? I mean, I went over this plea transcript quite a bit, and I mean, the prosecutor did say, you know, this is a guideline sentence, and there was no mention of an upward departure with respect to the plea agreement. There was no mention of an upward departure in the plea petition or in the sentencing transcript anywhere. So what do we make of that?
Right. I think that it is unfortunate that we don't have some of the right words in the record here that would make this a really clear finding for the court. And I think that in the state's view, that the way I see this court could affirm is simply to find some material differences from Rushton. Obviously, Rushton is binding on this court. It is helpful. It is the only case that is out there really that's applying Hodges. And so it's obviously critical. That's the case that's going to point the way for this court. And so, you know, the state is certainly not asking this court to overturn that or try to create a new rule of law. And instead, the state's position is simply that on these specific facts, there's a few material differences from Rushton that could maybe give us a path to affirm the sentence as it is. The first material difference that I see from Rushton is that the cases involve, you know, different subdivisions of the life sentence statute. And why this is relevant, in my view, is that Rushton, the basis for the life sentence was prior convictions. And although those prior convictions fall into essentially a legislatively created aggravating factor, it is essentially an offender characteristic that the offender is more dangerous. And so on that record, that fact of the prior conviction doesn't actually have any bearing on whether the facts of the current case are any more serious than a typical case. Whereas, you know, it's an offender characteristic that the legislature has decided district courts can use to basically kind of count criminal history scores, giving it sort of double the impact. Here, on the other hand, we have a heinous factor that was found that is an aggravating fact that demonstrates that the case itself is more serious than a typical criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. In Rushton, the underlying criminal sexual conduct case was charged as an under 13 or under 16 position of authority, if I'm remembering the facts correctly. And it describes that there was digital penetration when the victim was asleep and he was in a position of authority. And that's the bare facts. And so there's no facts there that a judge found or that were elicited in the record that are indicating a more serious offense. Whereas here we have an appellant who admitted the aggravating facts in the factual basis that support that finding, and that he was inflicted great bodily harm, sexually assaulting and permanently scarring the victim with a 400-degree curling iron. And he stipulated to the entirety of the victim's testimony. And so in my view, the records look different because it's not merely a prior conviction that doesn't actually illuminate whether the offense itself was more serious. Whereas here we have a situation where I believe that everybody in the courtroom recognized that the case itself was committed in aggravated fashion and that it warranted the statutory max of the minimum incarceration period. And so I think that everyone involved knew that was what was happening and that it was a substantially more serious case than usual, but the right words obviously, you know, weren't set on the record or we wouldn't be here today. And another reason that I see a difference between Rushton and this case would be that here appellant did waive having a jury make the factual findings beyond a reasonable doubt of that heinous or aggravating factor. Whereas in Rushton, since it was a prior conviction, that is essentially an exception to when a jury needs to be making the Blakely findings. That's the exception of when you don't have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury is prior convictions. And so you don't have that waiver of the Blakely jury as well. So here, you know, and obviously it's not in and of itself enough that the appellant agreed to this departure to the minimum term of incarceration of 360 months. We have that fact as well.
Yeah, but I mean, I agree with all of that. This is a heinous, awful crime. And people plead guilty to terrible, awful crimes all the time. And I mean, I had a front row seat to this when I was a district court judge where people would admit to crimes that I thought were substantially more serious than the typical offense, but they didn't get an upward departure because it wasn't agreed to. And I know that he waived Blakely, but he did not agree to a quote upward departure from the sentencing guidelines in the transcript. So how do we get around that? How do we get around that fact?
Right. I saw that appellant in his reply brief pointed out that in his view of the facts, that since no one said it was an upward, he didn't agree to an upward. And what I will say is that on this record, I think in a way it's illogical to say that he didn't know that this was more than the usual prison term for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, because that's what he was charged with before he was indicted back in September of the prior year. And so when he was facing a determinate sentence, a CrimSex 1, you know, he and his attorney talked about obviously the penalties. We have that in the evidentiary hearing. And then everything changed when he was indicted. And so no one in the room thought that 3-6, I mean, I know that no one said it wasn't a departure on the minimum term of incarceration, but no one in that room thought that 360, the statutory max, was the guideline sentence for a criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. And so in that view, I think that, you know, he agreed to the 360 and we, you know, the record as a whole, that context of how this case unfolded would show us that he knew that that would be more than what you would face on a typical CrimSex 1 without all of this, without the heinous factors.
Ms. Wilkes, can you cite to a binding case that holds that parole eligibility is a collateral consequence, going back to the issue that we discussed with Ms. Lozo?
I would say no. In Minnesota, I don't think we have that case law. What I would point two,
about,
I would.
What about U.S. Supreme Court then?
No, and I apologize. I think that there's a misstatement in my brief that was pointed out in the reply brief, and I apologize that I must have been hasty in my research, since there the U.S. Supreme Court was summarizing what the lower court held, and there's a footnote that says they didn't address that, and I apologize for that. I didn't mean to misstate that law. I think that, as far as I know, that there's not U.S. Supreme Court case law on that, and I think partially because the way they analyze the misadvice claims is a little bit different. And I don't think they talk as much about when it's collateral and not collateral, whereas we have a different framework here with Ellis Strong from this court. I think that the analysis looks a little different on the state level. So no, I don't think there's a U.S. Supreme Court case that says so. And here in Minnesota, I would only point to Ellis Strong, which references and summarizes a little bit of the federal case law that indicates that it would be a collateral consequence.
So basically, you're relying on persuasive authority. There's not anything binding.
No, there's nothing I know of that answers this question conclusively for the court. I think that the language that I cite in my brief about collateral consequences as factors that are unrelated to the plea itself and the analysis I have in my brief is what I would rely upon, that the myriad factors that are involved in parole eligibility, as was already discussed, I believe, with opposing counsel, are things that happen far in the future after the sentence is completed, things that like consulting with the victim's opinion and whether or not treatment's been completed, factors that are totally unrelated to the plea itself.
So why wouldn't this be considered, even if you are correct and that persuasive, there's plenty of persuasive authority out there, why isn't this resulting in inequitable conduct when he's being informed by his attorney of these consequences, and this is really going to the heart of why he's making a decision of whether to plea or not?
Well, I think it depends on sort of which track of the analysis that we're talking about. But if we're talking about his attorney's advice, and if we're, talking about the under the Strickland analysis,
yeah.
Right. In my view, neither Strickland factor is met here. I think that under the first prong, the attorney gave information. It's not wrong information when you read the evidentiary hearing. Could she have given, more information about parole, perhaps, but then the question, is how much information is she obligated to give? How granular does the description need to be? Do attorneys normally tell their clients about the rules of prison that they have to follow in order to not have infractions end up prolonging their time? Instead, I would urge the court to sort of return to the standard review, which is that first, the court starts with a strong presumption that the attorney's conduct, falls within the objective standards of reasonableness, their performance, and it's the appellant's burden to show otherwise. And here, I think when you take the trial attorney's testimony as a whole, that, I certainly don't think her performance was objectively unreasonable in her description to him that it was that parole is not guaranteed, that it's up the Department of Corrections. She said it was a possibility. She, in her testimony, she reiterated those points multiple times. And then I would say the other piece to that is that we certainly don't have on this record here proof that that is why he took this deal that he wouldn't have otherwise taken. I'm happy to answer any other questions that the panel may have. Otherwise, I can conclude if there are no further questions.
Anything else from the panel this morning? Ms. Folks, go ahead.
Thank you. Just in conclusion, I would reiterate that it is the state's position today that parole eligibility is a collateral consequence and that misinformation about a collateral consequence cannot render a plea involuntary or unintelligent as a matter of law. And that although misinformation about collateral consequences can constitute ineffective assistance of counsel, here the record shows appellant did not meet his burden on either of the Strickland prongs, and that nor did the district court's, you know, sort of inartful statements about parole constitute an unfulfillable promise or inducement, that there's been there's no record to show that those statements by the district court are why appellant entered into this agreement. It's abundantly clear in this record that it would not be fair and just to allow appellant to withdraw his plea that was entered midway through trial after the victim testified about appellant's horrific acts. So the respondent asked this court to affirm the denial of appellant's plea withdrawal motion and remand the case for resentencing. And appellant's offenses should be sentenced in the correct order upon a correct criminal history score. And respondent respectfully requests this court, upon these facts, affirm the agreed upon sentence, which included what is considered a departure in the minimum term of incarceration that was pronounced on the life sentence. Thank you. All
right. Thank you, counsel. We'll reset the clock for you, counsel. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start rebuttal by just addressing a couple of the points on the sentencing issue that the state's counsel made before returning to the chief judge's question about inducement of plea. So the state's argument, as in the brief and as stated here, is essentially that that this could be affirmed as an unintended departure because he pled guilty to, or because he admitted that heinous element. Rushton specifically forecloses that possibility, not to mention the other law and Williams and Geller et al. That state that a departure can't be affirmed if there's no substantial and compelling reasons. In that footnote 3 of Rushton, which I referred to earlier in argument, this court in its precedential decision specifically addressed that argument. It stated that the aggravating factor in Rushton's case, which aggravated the sentence from a normal CSC sentence to the life sentence that was imposed, cannot also serve as an aggravating factor that justifies departure. That's specifically stated in footnote 3 in Rushton, and that's consistent with generally applicable law. And regarding the state's point that that people knew this was going to be an especially serious sentence, The fact that Mr. Bell admitted that single aggravating factor is the reason the life sentence was imposed. That's the only reason that a life sentence could be imposed. And that's what makes the sentence here not a departure. Of course, the minimum term of imprisonment was a departure, an unlawful upward departure. But his admission to that one factor triggered the life sentence and is not and cannot be also a factor to justify departing from that sentence. That's stated in footnote 3 in Rushton. And even if it could be, as this court has already recognized, the general rule of law applied in cases like Williams and Geller is that a departure can't be affirmed if no one made any, or if the court did not find any substantial or compelling reasons for a departure. Here, that didn't happen because no one thought it was a departure. That's far more than not simply saying the right words. That's trying to change what everyone thought was actually happening, which was the imposition of the presumptive sentence for what Mr. Bell pled guilty to.
Sorry to interrupt. I had another question. I wanted to follow up on something that Judge Frisch raised earlier, and I think it's a good point. When we look at the whole context of what happened here, what he pleaded to, he had been offered a number of different plea deals prior to trial, somewhere between 25 to 30 years. And he said, no, I do not want to. I want to go to trial. And then after the victim testified, he realized, the record seems to indicate that he realized that it may not be going well. And at that point, if he was convicted, he would have faced life without the possibility of parole. And the state somewhat reluctantly agreed to make a plea offer when he had asked for it after the first 2 days of testimony, including from the victim. And what he had agreed to was life with the possibility of release. In other words, life 30 with parole. So it seems to me that he was never misinformed in terms of what he was agreeing to. He was agreeing to 30 years of a life sentence with the possibility of parole. How that parole is determined, isn't that then just a collateral consequence? Isn't the direct consequence of whether it's life 30 with parole or the option of going to trial and life without the possibility of parole?
Well, Your Honor, as I stated in my briefing, I believe that because, as the court said in Kaiser, because it affects the range of his possible punishment, the application of an indeterminate release date is a direct consequence. But if this court thinks it's a collateral consequence and decides that, as argued in the brief, there is still two different bases to reverse the or to allow him to withdraw his plea, which is that he was misinformed by both the court and counsel of that direct of that collateral consequence. So turning to the chief judge's question, because I do want to make sure I get to that before the time expires, you can see where that erroneous information induced the plea in pages 17 through 19 of the motion hearing transcript, where his attorney, his trial attorney, his plea counsel is testifying, testimony which the district court credited, about what Mr. Bell was talking to her about when trying to enter the plea. She says that he was very, very adamant that he wanted me to assure that he would get out at 30 years minus his credit. I'll turn to page 18. He really, really, really wanted me to get assurance from Judge Scoggin before he would take the plea on that issue of whether he would be released. And so I would just direct the court to 17 through 19, most specifically to address that reliance question. Obviously, my time has expired. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Judge Frisch, if I may ask.
You may. Yes.
I want to follow up on that point, because didn't she tell him, though, didn't she testify at the evidentiary hearing that she told him, I can't guarantee that you will, and I don't think the judge can either. That is up to a third party. That is not up to the judge. And I'm certainly willing to ask him, but he's going to tell you the same thing. It's not up to him as part of sentencing to guarantee that he will get out in 30 years.
She did testify that she said that she could not guarantee a specific release date. That's true. But
right.
Given
and the district court credited her testimony on that point.
That's
right?
True. But given all of the other misinformation about how his release date would be decided and determined, if it actually ever comes, that mere statement that no one can guarantee what date you'll be released doesn't cure all of the misinformation, particularly given by the court, about assuring him that he would be released after serving his minimum term of imprisonment plus any disciplinary confinement time, which is what he was specifically assured by the court.
Mr. Loza, I'm going to follow up on that. I mean, I think there is a distinction, however fine, with your client's desire for an assurance of a guaranteed release date after 30 years, and his current claim, which is the factors that the DOC uses to determine eligibility for release were not fully disclosed to me. And so what I think what Judge Siegel, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chief, but I think what she's asking is, where in the record is there some indication that the linchpin of his entering a plea depended upon something to do with the thing that he was not fully informed about? Where is that in the record?
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree that it's just a question of he didn't know the right factors. I think that it's crucial to understand that what he was misinformed of and misunderstood is that an entirely different release regime applies to him. For determinate sentencing, it's
the
just
factors.
It's not you look at different factors. With determining sentencing, it's determinate, which is not his sentence. It's what's the length of your sentence and did you get any discipline in prison? And you apply those two numbers and you get a release date. Here, for what he got, and that was the regime that the judge told him he was going to get if he pled guilty. And instead, what he actually pled guilty to was a regime where, regardless of his prison record, he is never guaranteed any release date. And when you look at the record, to return kind of ultimately to the question that you asked to finish it up, when you look at the record, it shows on 17 through 19, as I pointed out in his own testimony, that he was concerned with being released, vitally concerned with being released after serving his minimum term of imprisonment. If he had a determinate sentence, which he was told by the court he would have, he would have been guaranteed that if he didn't get prison discipline. Because he didn't get that type of sentence, he is guaranteed nothing. He may be in prison till the day he dies. And that's the difference. And that's what he was misinformed of and what he didn't understand.
But was he misinformed about that? That's where I am not sure that he was misinformed about that. He was informed that rather than going to trial and facing life without the possibility of parole, he now had the possibility of parole. How that decision is made is out of the sentencing court's hands. It's the issue of whether or not at least he now has the possibility of being released after 30 years.
Well, the misinformation, Your Honor, came, and I'm referring just specifically to the court here. Of course, the brief discusses the attorney's misinformation as well. But the court, before he was pleading guilty, when giving that assurance that the attorney testified Mr. Bell wanted before pleading guilty, specifically told him that at the end of 30 years, and I'm just reading from page 4 to 5 of the motion here, or excuse me, of the plea hearing here, at the end of 30 years, the Commissioner of Corrections will assess your conduct in prison and make a decision about whether any infractions have occurred that would extend the period of time that you're in jail, just or in prison, just like they would for any other prisoner. I'm skipping ahead a little bit. You know, if you are serving 2 years on a 3-year sentence, can be extended. The 2-year sentence can be extended because you had infractions in prison. That same process will apply. So that's the, just with regard to just what the court said, and obviously the rest is cited in the brief, but that is misinformation. That's simply not true. And it relates directly to how his release date will be determined. And that's the misinformation just in that portion that Mr. Bell would point to and that we're relying on regarding the claim of the judicial misinformation. And of course, the judge also said other things subsequently, but those are in the briefs and the court has seen.
Chief, did you want to follow up? Okay. Anything else from the panel? All right. Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments. They were very helpful along with your briefs.